Howdy and welcome to Thin Air News with an Altitude from your High Country Public Radio stations. I'm John Kovash.
I'm Anne Beauvais. Howdy. This month, what was it like for Japanese Americans to grow up in rural Colorado?
And then in 1925, my dad was the first one to bring his family and come. And they came on a train.
Vail forest activists are off the hook for now.
We visit some art scavengers in New Mexico.
It's almost as if you have a different set of hands and a different set of eyes.
But first, some news from around thin air country.
In Steamboat Springs, 44 out of 56 ski patrollers have voted to unionize. Steamboat is owned by one of the ski glomerates, American Skiing Company, which last season saw an exodus of longtime Steamboat employees after a series of cost-cutting measures. The Steamboat patrollers now expect to negotiate for their salaries and to have a say in hiring and firing practices. Ski patrol unions already exist at Aspen, Keystone, and Breckenridge.
In Rifle, Colorado, the town council has killed a deal with the Department of Wildlife that called for digging a $2 million pipeline through the town's mountain park. The state wanted to pump 9 cubic feet per second from East Rifle Creek to provide whirling disease-free water to the Rifle Fish Hatchery. Town residents expressed concern over proposed blasting for the pipeline. Of Colorado's 17 state fish hatcheries, only three are currently free of whirling disease. They are at Salida, Carbondale, and Glenwood Springs.
A new campaign called Free the Snow seeks to overturn the ban on snowboards at the Aspen Mountain, Taos, and Alta ski areas. Boarders are presenting their arguments on a website called freethesnow.com. The Aspen Skiing Company says a new survey will be done concerning snowboarders. Also in Aspen, the city council is calling for national limits on immigration. In what may be the first such local resolution, Aspen is calling for enforcement of immigration laws and for 5 years to limit annual immigration to 100,000 people.
Members of the High Country Community Radio Coalition have agreed to a mission statement for a new nonprofit that would be devoted to sharing of programming and training resources among stations. The stations are now operating a new FTP site for exchange of stories on the internet. This edition of Thin Air is the first to carry sound that spent time as an MP3 file going through the telephone lines. If you are interested in posting sound to Thin Air, contact your local station.
Scores of green groups are challenging by petition how the Forest Service manages off-road vehicles on public lands. Supporters in Buena Vista say ORVs are having direct impacts to wetlands and water quality in the Four Mile Creek area and the Arkansas River north of town. The Center for Global Food Issues is predicting an exploding world population of pets, which consume resource-expensive foods like fish and meat byproducts. Betsy Hale at the Delta Montrose Agricultural Development Project says Western Colorado ranchers could develop high-quality, natural, maybe even organic animal feeds. Last month, the Colorado Economic Forecast for the Millennium was presented by CU Professor Richard Wobbekind. It was a mixed forecast for the state as a whole, a bit of an economic slowdown with Colorado's furious job creation rate dropping to below the 3% mark. Wobbekind also sees a year 2000 plateau for the equally robust real estate market, with fewer new homes being built in 2000. He expects passage of the Colorado Highway Bill to boost the concrete and gravel industries, but not to create a lot of new jobs. The professor takes comfort in Colorado's, for the West, relatively high per capita income, but he does see some downsides.
The largest negatives are higher cost of living increases, with more pressure on the housing markets and on the other services that are here that are local in nature. We see continued pressure on prices that'll have the consumer price index rising about a full point higher in Colorado than it does in the nation as a whole. clearly, some of the citizenry would also say that the growth rate makes it difficult for infrastructure to keep up in terms of infrastructure being a part of quality of life.
The CU Business Department is bullish on tourism, with the expectation that more baby boomers will be traveling within the U.S. For the more rural and western slope areas, it's again a mixed forecast.
I think the Grand Junction economy, a couple of the really interesting statistics, the unemployment rate has gone way down from a year ago and is still higher than the states, but very competitive, very low unemployment rates. In general, I think you could say they look very solid. Their economy, though, continues to be very much based on retail and services. Some of that clearly, obviously, linked to the retirement aspects of that economy and the medical provision of medical services on the western slope. Also, there has been a pickup in tourism this year that's been noted out there. So that's, I think, a positive sign. And with the increased promotion of tourism in the year ahead with the new tourism promotion budget, we are optimistic that that's going to help as well. And we see similar things in Durango. We see similar slight pickup in tourism as reported by the economic reporting agents in that area. We see, again, good retail sales, good service provision. I think the entire western slope is a little bit distressed by a lack of economic diversification occurring as fast as they would like. And I think that really does continue to be the major issue. Now, the southwestern part of the state has made some significant inroads to putting in telecommunications backup capabilities, redundant capacity, if you will, that should allow that area to be more tuned into the digital economy, be safer for businesses to locate there, if you will, because they'll have plenty of capacity for telecommunications, and we think that will be positive over the long haul. But right now, the economy really continues to be a service and retail economy on the western slope.
The CU study points to a severe shortage of hourly workers and to large dissatisfaction among employers as to the quality of the hourly workforce. Meanwhile, Colorado's high-tech industries are finding their higher-paid employees by recruiting around the country and around the world.
Federal prosecutor investigating the Vail arsons has backed off on the jailing of forest activists to force testimony. Members of Ancient Forest Rescue who were in the vicinity during the Vail fires have balked at answering questions by arson investigators, and the debate continues over allowing ski expansion into prime lynx habitat. May Jarrell filed this report from KGNU in Boulder.
Did you guys hear the good news? It turns out that conscience beat greed and sinister pursuit of greed and corruption of justice. And the fact is, we won! So far, anyway.
A grand jury was convened to investigate last year's arson, when a restaurant and several outbuildings were burned to the ground at the Vail ski area. Several witnesses were called who were known to have been in the Vail area the night of the fire. Ben Dune, an activist with Ancient Forest Rescue, originally testified before the grand jury on October 19th. He is not considered a suspect in the arson. When he refused to divulge names of the other members of his organization, he was charged with contempt of court.
I appeared in front of the grand jury at 9 a.m., and the first thing he asked me was, you know, do you remember the questions you wouldn't answer last time? I said, yes. Do you remember refusing to answer them? I said, yes. So are you prepared to answer those questions today? I said, no. And I just went on saying that I felt like it was a violation of my First Amendment right to freedom of association, and that will have a chilling effect on our group's ability to peacefully assemble and organize in the future, that people are going to think twice about wanting to support an organization that gives its membership lists and things like that to the FBI and the feds.
Dune recollects his meeting with Prosecutor Buck after appearing before the grand jury.
He said that he's dropping the contempt charges, that he said he doesn't really feel right. He says about putting us in jail. He says he knows we didn't light the fires. He says he respects that we were standing on a principle. He was kind of annoyed that we didn't fully cooperate with him. And that was it. And I was just, I couldn't believe it. I did not see that coming at all.
Dune said he appreciated lawyers who assisted activists for free. Scott Silver, an activist who spoke at the rally, had questions of his own for the prosecutor.
It's true that we have every reason to wonder why Vail has not been a suspect in this fire, since they clearly had the most to gain from it.
Peg Millett, a forest activist from Arizona, shared songs and ideas at the rally.
And I sat down very quiet.
We need to live our convictions. We need to live our values. And the values of the culture that we live in, we're living in a death cult. And it's time for those of us who don't live in a death cult or who affirm life in our lives, we need to just live that. And that means activism. That's just the definition of it for me.
Activists are awaiting a listing decision by the U.S. Division of Wildlife regarding the status of the lynx as threatened or endangered. This could have an effect on the Vail expansion. This decision is expected on January 8th. For Thin Air, this is May Jarrell.
Break of dawn, I would dance in the evening light.
Eight years ago, Japanese planes dropped bombs on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, which led the United States into World War II and led to a drastic change in lifestyles for many Americans of Japanese heritage. Some were subjected to forced migration and internment camps, most to severe prejudice and hostility. In Colorado, a Japanese-American community flourished in San Luis Valley as early as the 1920s. There were two Buddhist churches, one in La Jara and one in Blanca. Bessie Konishi's family has been a part of that community since its inception. Last month, David Summerstein at KRZA in Alamosa spoke with Bessie Konishi. Her family was one of the first to relocate from Japan to San Luis Valley.
Bessie Konishi's living room stands in stark contrast to her husband's veterinary offices next door. While the clinic looks, well, like a veterinarian's clinic, an unadorned door in the waiting room opens into an elaborately decorated Japanese home. Rice paper-covered doors open to rooms with Japanese-lettered wall hangings and carefully sculpted plants. Water trickles from a sculpture and white globes cast a gentle light. The rooms show a great pride in the culture they evoke. Bessie is one of 12 children in the Konishi family. Her parents were part of the first permanent Japanese-American settlement in the San Luis Valley. Japanese-Americans first came here in 1908, bachelors who worked in the coal mines. Bessie tells me that some 60 men came here to work on the Alamosa-Levita railroad line.
And then about 1925, the first permanent Japanese settlers came to the San Luis Valley. And there's quite a story behind that, because there were two sets of circumstances that brought them here. There were a lot of Japanese living in California. And in 1913, the California legislature passed the Alien Land Law, which restricted holdings of land either purchased or leased by aliens and ineligible for citizenship, which meant whites only. And so they couldn't own land in California. And so they were seeking other places. And then the second circumstance, there was an availability of land here in the San Luis Valley, and there was a man named Mr. Gibson who owned just thousands of acres called Castilla Estates Company. And he sent two people to California to actually recruit Japanese farmers to come here because he knew this land was good farmland. And so as a result of that, two or three of the men came by themselves to check things out and went back. And then in 1925, my dad was the first one to bring his family and come. And they came on a train, and he brought his family with him. And my mother tells me she remembers living for a few nights in what is now Porter Realty, right on the end of Main Street. Used to be a boarding house, and they stayed in there a couple of nights. And they were sharecroppers, you know, because they couldn't own land. But they were treated very well. And they were good farmers, and so, gosh, they were pretty prosperous. And then they could start buying land under their children's names as they got older, you know, because the children were born here in the United States, so they were citizens. They even had their own packing shed, and yeah, they were really good farmers. Raised cauliflower, cabbage, green peas, carrots, potatoes.
We take a look at an old black and white enlarged photo. Some 50 people in a beautifully adorned wooden building. Everyone arranged around a center altar and dressed in their proverbial Sunday best. It's a picture of the dedication of the Lajara Buddhist Church.
The Lajara Buddhist Church was built in 1936, dedicated in 1937. And you know, the church was the center of our social activity, too. We'd go to school 5 days a week, and then on Saturday we'd pack a lunch, and we'd go to church, and we'd learn to speak and write Japanese. And you know, a lot of times we weren't invited to parties at school and by classmates and things like that because of prejudice. And so a lot of our social activity was centered around the church, too. Yeah. We had our own team, baseball team, softball team. We'd play other Japanese teams, like from the Arkansas Valley. And so we had fun. And every Father's Day, we'd have a picnic. We'd go up the Kanaz River somewhere. We'd have a picnic on Father's Day. And inside of the Buddhist church, there's a stage. And on top of the stage, behind closed doors, is the Buddhist altar. And so when we would have services, then the doors would be opened, and you could see the altar behind the doors, and that's when the services were held. And this was the place where we had our Hanamatsuri, which is a flower festival celebrating Buddha's birthday. And so we did that once a year in April, usually. And we'd learn Japanese dances and things like that and perform them on stage. And a lot of our teachers would even come and watch us, you know. When World War II broke out, and there was this executive order signed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt that ordered all Japanese Americans and Japanese off of the coast, off of the West Coast, into concentration camps. And if they had a sponsor inland, they could come in instead of going into the concentration camps. And so my dad and others who lived in this area called relatives from California, and so we had quite a large population here during World War II because of that.
The Lajara Buddhist Church was ordered to be boarded up. A few years later, members of the church were allowed to hold a funeral outside. Bessie and her sister referred to a photo of that funeral many times during our interview. Same number of people as the dedication photo, same Sunday best, but the people are outside, the altar left inside, the doors and windows boarded up.
And the picture shows, it's really sad to me, because we weren't allowed to meet in the Buddhist church at that time. And so, and the windows were being broken, so that it's all boarded up. And look at the grass, how high it is, you know, because the weeds were growing, because we weren't allowed to meet. But they did allow us to meet and have a funeral there. And so they took a picture of the funeral here. And I think it's really a sad picture just because of the fact, you know, that the windows are boarded up and that we couldn't even meet. Well, I understood that there was a war between Japan and China and United States, and that I was Japanese. I was born in the United States, but I was still Japanese. You know, you can't cover up what you look like. I mean, you know, this is me, you know. You can't cover it up. Like the Italians and Germans, you know, they weren't bothered as much because they could blend in with the rest of the kids. But if you're Japanese, you know, there's no way you can cover that up. But, yeah, I understood. But there was a lot of confusion, too, because I thought, but I am Japanese. I still had relatives over there. My grandparents are still over there. Aunts, cousins, you know. And they were innocent, just like the people over here were innocent. All because of politics, I always think, you know, because of greedy politicians, you know. And I think that's what it is. That's what war is, I think. The innocent people have to suffer because of that.
This month, Connie Gotch, our Four Corners Arts correspondent, talks to two New Mexico artists who look to the common junk drawer to find meaning among household objects.
We've both always been very interested in walking around in nature and seeing what kinds of wonderful things are laying around.
Two Santa Fe artists, Gail and Zachariah Rieke, collaborate to place found objects into trunks and boxes, collages, cabinets, and chests.
I always loved to go to the beach when I was little and find shells and come back and arrange them all. And I guess this is just a continuation of that.
Looking into these spaces is like digging through the universal catch-all drawer. These musings usually happen when no one else is present, and the Riekes catch this kind of moment.
Sometimes these pieces have a kind of a very quiet, private sense to them. The kind of thing that you might just come to when you're alone and do it very quietly and think about what's there.
Arranging what seems to be flotsam and jetsam into exciting stuff has fascinated the Riekes for many years.
I was getting a degree in drawing, and I started drawing with all kinds of people so that I could extend my repertoire and see what other people would do in response to my marks. And then I started drawing with Zach. There was a real uncanny connection there. And we've been collaborating for 30 years now, so it's almost as if you have a different set of hands and a different set of eyes.
Usually the Riekes open the boxes for people in their home, but now they have an exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts in Santa Fe, Found Objects in an Open World. Looking at the collection is like sharing an intimate idea with yourself. If you're a photographer, a scrap of mirror on a vanity might become a faded daguerreotype, and the real daguerreotype next to it simply a tarnished mirror. If you're not a fussy housekeeper, a light bulb or a pair of glasses flop on the table just as they do at home.
This one in particular is a mirror table, and it has a lot of mirror objects on it, very much about reflection. So they are self-contained in a certain way, and then they extend out into the space.
The process of making the box can become as important as the end result.
And you can see records of different layerings of processes when you look at the painting. One of the first things that Zach did was he took a whole series of Earl Grey tea bags and he laid them out on a grid on a blank canvas, and then he poured boiling water on them so that the stain of the tea would go into the canvas. This box has reference to writing and to writing implements, part of an old Webster's dictionary that has symbols for different sounds in various languages, and some found objects that really look like Chinese characters or Japanese characters.
Gee, isn't that a lot like cleaning out your desk, finding old bills, and discovering how all your activities and resulting expenses relate over the past 3 months? Gail and Zachariah's art offers another way to think about the objects and ideas around us.
The exhibit, Found Objects in an Open World, shows through January 23rd at the Museum of Fine Arts in Santa Fe.
Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is a project of the High Country Community Radio Coalition.
Funding comes from your station and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You might be listening to KRZA Alamosa, KAJX Aspen, KGNU Boulder, KDNK Carbondale, or KBUT in Crested Butte.
Or possibly KDUR Durango, KZMU Moab, KVNF Paonia, KOTO Telluride, KAFM Grand Junction, or KRCL in Salt Lake City.
Thin Air is available on the public radio satellite system and on the internet at kgnu.org. You can reach us at thinair@telluridecolorado.net.